This is The Gaggle with David Helfenbein.
On The Gaggle this week, we have on Paul Singer. Paul Singer is Washington correspondent at USA Today, where he directs and produces coverage of legislation, political campaigns, and congressional ethics. Paul, it is a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave. Appreciate it.
Paul, I'd like to start off with your background as an investigative reporter. You have done many investigations in your career. Can you discuss some of the biggest investigations you've done into congressional expenditures and transparency and the way that Congress does business?
Sure. One of the more recent ones that was kind of fun is I was involved in some of the coverage of Congressman Aaron Schock of Illinois, who... I'd say our reporting and the reporting of Politico and Chicago Sun-Times and a few other outlets managed to chase him from office. And the gist of this is the Washington Post wrote a story saying, gosh, this congressman from Illinois has a Downton Abbey-themed redecoration going on in his congressional office. And the reporter ran into, while he was looking at the office, this woman who said she was the decorator for the congressman. And he said, oh, that's nice. She's like, oh, I did it all for free. When that story published, I looked at it and some of my other pals who are ethics mavens, I guess you would call us, looked at it and said, well, he can't get a free interior decorating service. That's illegal. That's an illegal gift under congressional ethics rules. So I dug into the House expenditure records, which is one of my favorite things to do, and found $100,000 worth of expenses Aaron Schock had spent from the taxpayer-funded accounts to redecorate his other offices. And it included all this stuff like marble countertops and leather furniture and a handmade presidential-style podium for giving speaking events, stuff that seemed really excessive. So we published that story basically less than 24 hours after the Washington Post story came out, and it began this whole series of stories that followed about how he was spending his money. Politico figured out that he was reimbursing himself for a car for far more miles than the car could have possibly driven. We figured out that he was taking improper charter flights, again, on the taxpayer dime, all over the place. The Sun-Times was the one that figured out he flew to a football game on a taxpayer dime. All of it listed in public records, which we were able to extract and figure out what he was actually paying for. And before the Congress was able to sort of adjudicate what he had done wrong, he quit, and he's now being investigated by the Justice Department. So that was a pretty successful project. We enjoyed that one.
Why do you think a congressman would do something like that?
It's a really good question, Dave. I mean, this is – so I have spent years poking through congressional expenditure records. They're public documents. They are large public documents. They're the size of a phone book. They come out every quarter in the House and once every 6 months in the Senate. And they just list everything the office spent. The Senate is actually less detailed than the House, but nevertheless – and we find all kinds of interesting things. Some of them are errors, right? For example, Senator from New Mexico, Martin Heinrich, was listing in the books this $20, $30, $40 expense more or less every day he was in Washington. And it didn't amount to much. I mean, it was a couple thousand dollars. I was like, what is this? And it looked to me like he was paying for his own Uber or taxi cab to and from his house, from the home to the office. Sure enough, that's what he was doing, which is fine, but it's illegal. You're not allowed to do it. The congressional expenditure rules are very clear. The taxpayer will not pay for your own commute. So we called him up and said, what's this? You can't pay for your commute. And they apologized and paid back a couple thousand dollars. Small thing, little issue, clearly a mistake, whatever. That's the easy stuff. The harder stuff is members of Congress use this money for, oh, I don't know, I will hire my communications consultant from the campaign to work in my congressional office. That seems not quite right. Well, it can be and it cannot be, depending on what rules you follow. We found one guy who the chief of staff left the office, that is, you know, quit the office after many, many years, and started his own consulting firm back home in Illinois. And the congressman then rehired him on a monthly contract to provide consulting services, including writing press releases, writing speeches, etc., while the guy was running a lobbying firm back in his hometown. He was actually, in some cases we think, working for clients who had business before the congressman. You can't do that. So the question is, why? Is it just because you like the guy, you know the guy, you don't think it matters that he's working for both sides of the street? Is it because you're trying to cheat? Is it because you think that no one's going to notice that you're spending this money on taxpayer accounts? I can never figure it out. Every time I stumble across one of these, I think, what were these people thinking?
How do you personally feel when you find that someone does something wrong, like Aaron Schock, and you write the story?
Well, it's a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, on the one hand, we're very proud. I believe, and this requires a little bit of explanation, if you don't mind, if I digress for a second, about the way the congressional ethics rules work. By and large, members of Congress are sort of policed, I guess you would say, by an ethics committee, one in the House and one in the Senate, that exists for the sole purpose of preventing them from getting in trouble. Right? The ethics committee's jobs, by and large, is to give advice to the members of Congress so they don't get in trouble. The ethics committees don't want to actually punish anybody. And under a whole series of odd federal rules, it's very difficult to prosecute a member of Congress for misusing federal money unless you can really line up all the ducks and nail them. And in fact, it's still Aaron Schock's case is still a year later sort of wending through the courts. So the news story, the embarrassing news story, is the only real punishment. The Ethics Committee is never going to kick you out of Congress. The Justice Department is never going to throw you in jail. What's going to happen is I'm going to find out about the misdeed. I'm going to write the story. It's going to be public. Your opponent is going to use it in your next election, and you may not survive. So I feel when we have written our story, we have participated in the adjudication of a wrongdoing. But the flip side is, because we are essentially our own judge and jury and don't actually have any oversight of our own, right? We're just a reporter, a report news outlet. It means we have to be very, very cautious about what we say and how we write it, because we cannot, knowing that the story we write is going to be used possibly to essentially end your career, we have to be very, very clear that we can prove what we're saying, that we know it's a violation, and you have done something actually wrong, not just that we want a headline saying, ooh, don't you look like a bad boy.
You tracked billions of dollars of federal disaster relief money for Hurricane Katrina. Can you discuss this?
Yeah, it's the same sort of process, actually. I love following the money. I hate talking to people, by and large, because people lie. But when you find the documents and the money, you have the actual facts. And Katrina was one of these things where a year after the hurricane, for the one-year anniversary, I was working for a publication called National Journal, we thought we would do a one-page magazine story summarizing what happened to the $100 billion, $100 billion with a B, dollars, that Congress had approved for Hurricane Katrina recovery operations. And literally, we thought it would be a one-page magazine article. It turned out, when I started to look into it, nobody actually knew where it was. The deal is that Congress approved the money and gave it to the federal agencies and said, go ahead and spend it. But the federal agencies weren't really tracking exactly how it was being spent. They were frequently telling the states, okay, go ahead, you have permission. Or they were going to the other federal agencies and saying, oh, hey, EPA, we need you to go clean up the hazardous materials. We'll pay you for that. Oh, hey, Coast Guard, we need you to clear out the waterways. We'll pay you for that. But they weren't keeping track in any single place. There was no single reporting structure for $100 billion. So I had to go find it all. And it became this hilarious thing. I had two pieces of flip chart paper taped to my wall And I would like note in the corner, you know, here was this $100 billion. I'd staple to it a piece of paper with a report from FEMA on this, you know, $10 billion section. And then I would staple to that a report that I'd gotten from Louisiana about the portion of the money that Louisiana had used. And I would stand there tossing my baseball, staring at my chart with circles and arrows all over it, going, I'm still missing $7 billion. Where is it? That became, I had this moment in that research where I ended up in New Orleans, still having nobody able to explain to me where all this money was. I'd spent weeks on the phone. I called the General Accounting Office, and sorry, now called the Government Accountability Office, and they said basically, yeah, we haven't been able to check it either. If you find us, let us know. If you find it, let us know. And I ended up in Louisiana, and I was talking to the director of emergency response in Louisiana. And it was just an amazing moment. I, you know, he pulled out a napkin, and he drew how the money is distributed, where it all goes, how it gets drawn down, who spends it on what, who's responsible for it, with, you know, four or five little pots. Well, here's where there's $20 billion over here, and there's $30 billion over here, and then this portion hasn't been spent yet, that's $10 billion over there. And it was just right there. This, it was like the Rosetta Stone he had handed to me. And I walked out of that meeting into the parking lot, and I literally had tears in my eyes. I felt like I have been searching for this grail now for 6 weeks, and people have been telling me that it doesn't exist. And now I have it written on the back of a napkin. It made it all, everything else, all my rest of my reporting possible.
There is a great story that you wrote for USA Today, Why Journalism Students Need Improv Classes, back in February.
Yeah.
And just to quote one sentence from it, for instance, the Senate has a press gallery for print reporters and another for broadcast reporters. If I got to a press conference and shoot live video from my iPhone, posting it to Twitter via Periscope, which am I? Can you discuss a little bit how the role of a reporter has changed over the years and how it's changed for you in particular?
Oh, yeah. You know, once upon a time, I've been in this business for 30 years or more. So once upon a time, I would go to a press conference. I would write down what was said at the press conference. I would, you know, go and talk to someone in the hallways after the press conference. I would then go back to my office and make a couple of phone calls to ask some people what they thought of all of this information. And I would write the story by 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would send it to my bosses, and they would publish it. Publish it meaning it would show up in the next morning's newspaper. It doesn't work like that anymore. Possibly the best example was there was a shooting on Capitol Hill a few weeks ago. Maybe it's a few months ago now. Time kind of flies. And I happened to be in the Capitol building when this guy came to the security desk. He was going through the metal detectors. They detected a gun. It turned out I think it was not a real gun. And they told him to drop his weapon. He did not, so they fired at him. Well, Capitol goes into shutdown mode. Obviously, we are all in lockdown. We can't get out of our offices. Not many reporters on the Hill that day. It was a recess day. This is breaking news on Twitter. We're all tweeting about it. I found a place where I could actually see through a window to watch the cops running around the Capitol up on the plaza. I'm taking pictures out of a bathroom window, posting them to Twitter. My colleagues back at the headquarters office are actually writing the story because they've got more access to news than I do. I'm locked down. But then I got an email saying, can you Periscope? So as soon as they let me out of the building, I went out onto the sidewalk in front of the Capitol and did what would be a normal sort of TV news stand-up. Hey, it's Paul Singer with USA Today. I'm in front of the Capitol building. Here's what happened today. See over there. That's where this happened. All on my iPhone. And then I posted it to Periscope. USA Today took that video, posted it on our top of our story, and it became our video about the incident. I would never even conceived of doing something like that 15 years ago. I was now the video producer. I was the first alert tweeter. I was everything except the guy writing the story. Very strange.
What was the River Street News?
Well, if you can find a copy, the River Street News was my first journalism job. One summer in the mid-1970s, I was bored and looking for something to do. And I always sort of wanted to be a reporter. And I think this is slightly after Watergate. So, you know, being a reporter was a sexy thing at the time. And so I started doing a little one-page newspaper for the six houses on the end of my block. River Street was the street we lived on. And I would go interview the guy next door who was building a barbecue. You know, tell me about the barbecue. And we wrote up a story about the barbecue. And then, you know, we did it for, I don't know, a couple of weeks. And then we do one or two or three of them. They're kind of irregular. And then one of my neighbors said, oh, I've got some larger paper. Would you like larger paper? So now I had to do a four-page newspaper every time, which was impossible. We were handwriting these things. We were making copies with carbon paper. It was pretty old school. And I was, I think, 9 years old. So sooner or later, I got bored of it. So I think there's only really, there is, I think, one or two copies left. But it was my first venture into journalism, and I loved it. I don't think I have ever stopped doing journalism for any significant period since then. I mean, I started a newspaper the next year, again, a one-page joke sheet, basically, for my fifth-grade class. In sixth and seventh grade, I was on the TV crew. We had a little media center in the middle school. You know, every opportunity to do journalism since 1970, whatever that was, six, I guess, 75, something like that, I have been a reporter ever since.
Which brings me to the final question, which is a really important one for people who want to enter the field. You clearly love your job. What advice do you have for people who want to enter a career like yours?
My first advice is this advice that nobody ever takes, but I still believe it, which is this: never do it for the paycheck. If the reason you're here is, particularly in journalism, is because the paycheck, it's going to burn out really, really fast. It's just not, you have to love what you're doing. You have to want to come to work because of what you're producing. You have to want to come to work because it's bringing you some meaning, that you think you're really contributing something to the world. It can't be just like, well, you know, it pays the rent. And there are jobs you do that for, and there are jobs you, I mean, I've done those jobs too. I worked in a deli for years because it paid the rent, but it wasn't where I put my focus, my time, and my career. And so I still just, I don't want to know what I get paid, because I don't want the paycheck to be the reason I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I can't do anything else. It is just what I love. Look for the career that makes your heart, not that makes your wallet.
Paul Singer, Washington correspondent at USA Today. Really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure, Dave. Thanks for having me. Be well.